This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Your Genes podcast. It sounds kind of interesting because when we consider what we're doing in life is we are biologically trying to further our genetic reproduction. And that's what the purpose, the biological purpose at least of life. And what we're trying to do at this podcast is we are seeking to understand what our genes are trying to get us to do and to see if that actually matches up with what's going to make us happy. And in a lot of cases that actually does make us happy. For instance, our genes are designed to keep us safe. So if you're crossing a street and there might be a car that's about to hit you, your genes are going to be the ones that are going to motivate you to get you out of the way. However, in things like relationships, love, sex, work, food, all kinds of different things in life are there where your genes may be getting you to do things that are beneficial for the genes, but they're not beneficial for your happiness. So we are seeking to look at different examples in life through these podcasts where we seek to understand where our genes are in favor of our happiness and where they're not, and where they're not, we're going to be trying to beat those genes. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today? Welcome. Thank you for coming back this week.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here, Nate.
All right. So last week, we had a couple of real-life situations from listeners, from other stories that I gathered from different avenues. And we had a really interesting turnout with some more questions. I found some more some examples here. Now, if there's anybody listening here and they come up with some questions of their own that they want some clarification about, feel free to give us a call live on the show. We are live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The phone number to call in is 657-383-0751. However, if you feel nervous about calling in, feel free to email me. You can email us at beatyourgenes@gmail.com. And if you want to have a couple of questions, maybe some personal questions about to clarify an issue or to maybe have Dr. Lyle lift some pressure off of a situation, feel free to email me. We can arrange a time to talk about this off air and then record it separately and put it on the podcast. So again, the email is beatyourgenes@gmail.com and the call-in number is 657-383-0751. So, Dr. Lyle, did you have a good time last week going over all these real-life situations?
I sure did. Those were very interesting, and I think it's good for folks to sort of listen their way through other people's struggles because probably many people have similar issues, and so hopefully the principles we talk about might be useful.
Wonderful. Well, we have some more real-life examples this week that I want to go over with you, and I'm curious to see because I actually just came back from Las Vegas. I was visiting visiting a friend there, and it was very interesting to look at this lens of basically freedom, and people are able to display however they want in a city where it's designed to kind of you can really be yourself. And it was very interesting through the lens of evolutionary psychology to see the different mating strategies that were at play there. Dr. Lyle, have you ever been to Las Vegas?
Yes, I have. In the conservative part of Las Vegas, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, a friend of mine a long time ago kind of got me interested in evolutionary psychology. She ended up telling me, she said, yeah, after I learned enough about this, all I see are monkeys walking around and displaying certain things to each other and beating their chests when they need to.
Sure. That about sums it up.
All right. Well, let's not delay any further, and let's go for the first example here.
Right.
Okay. This is from a man, and he says, "My fiance and I have been dating for about 2.5 years. I proposed to her last December, and she said yes. And we've been working very hard to save up for our wedding and honeymoon. But 2 weeks ago, I asked her a question about her views on prenuptial agreements, and I have some general understanding of this." I'm assuming that's his profession. Well, she flipped out and said that she's not going to marry someone who doesn't trust her and is planning to leave her in the future. I explained to her that it wasn't about trust issues with her, but to financially protect both of us if we were ever to divorce or if the marriage just didn't work out. Well, she was really emotional about the whole issue, and this actually resulted in really bad drama. She yelled at me a lot, but I just quietly listened to her, and I hardly said much. I personally don't want both of us to financially suffer if a divorce happens. Now, I've worked very hard to save up for my future, multiple properties, IRA, Roth IRAs, 401ks, cars, in addition to family inheritances that will be handed down by my father and grandfather. I did explain to her that once we got married, everything is ours from the day we legally tie the knot. Well, she completely broke down eventually and left my house. Now, this drama happened about 2.5 weeks ago. Now, last week, I communicated with her by phone saying that she communicated with him by phone saying that she needs to rethink all this but wants a break. Now, it's getting to the point where she's bad-mouthing me to all her friends. She told them I was emotionally abusing her, and I didn't understand the emotional abuse, but I only calmly communicated about the prenuptial agreement. I don't know how this is emotional abuse. Now, even some of my best friends got upset at me because she told them about it, and I explained to them that this actually was not the case and told them my side of the story, and they understood and actually stood by my decision. Now, her female friends were very upset, and I had to cut contact with all of them. So based on this, I may have screwed up my relationship with my fiance. But what I want to know is it even worth pursuing, or should I let it go and move on?
Well, whoever this is, I have a couple of comments and questions for them. Number one, I don't know how old they are. It sounds like if this person has amassed properties and has a substantial net worth, then this is probably not somebody in their 20s. So this seems like an older person. The behavior of the woman in this case is indicative of somebody that's got some real limitations in terms of their personality. There's obviously a pretty significant entitlement streak that's going on here, and I'm sure this isn't the first time that this has surfaced. So I would say that when it comes to relationships, I would say if there is a mistake that people make in relationships, it's generally that they stay too long. So that is probably the most common large mistake that is made. There's various and sundry reasons why that is a common mistake today that would not have been the case in the Stone Age. There are societal and financial pressures that will keep relationships together when those relationships would be best off being severed. On the other hand, we don't want to be cavalier about relationships that are very significant. My attitude is we essentially turn over every reasonable rock on the beach in order to see whether or not a relationship exists that is worth fighting for. So we certainly do all the reasonable activities in order to see what will happen. In this case, I feel like this man accidentally stumbled over a beautiful stressor that put this woman under enough psychological pressure that she actually displayed her disagreeable characteristics. You are not entitled to somebody else's wealth. Nobody is entitled to anybody else's wealth. And what we should be delighted about is that we're in love with somebody. that we've actually found a person that we're considering spending the rest of our lives with. And if that person is much wealthier than we are, then and they want to be responsible with their finances, and they want to say, look, I'm going to support you. I'm going to be the big, obviously, I have the big net worth. That will influence our standard of living considerably. However, in terms of our, in terms of your future and my future, we actually have differences in our net worth, but not in our standard of living, which is what I've discussed before on a previous podcast. So two partners should not have a different standard of living. They shouldn't drive different level of cars. They shouldn't have different levels of vacations. They shouldn't have their independent differences in how much they can afford for clothing and their clothing style. In other words, they should be living in the same house under the same standard of living, but they could have very different networks. And so this is an entitlement on the part of the bride here that is very notable. What her reaction is, immature and irresponsible, and it's really not the kind of reaction that bodes very well for anybody in a long-term romantic love relationship, quite frankly. Romantic love relationships, long-term romantic love relationships, kind of require some really serious psychological chops. They are not for the unstable, disagreeable, low conscientiousness. They're really not fit very well for humans that are not quite responsible. And this reaction on the part of the female is quite irresponsible, and it's evidence of some serious limitations personality-wise. However, with that being said, my advice to this man would be to take your sweet time. I would certainly postpone any wedding if there's a wedding date. I would figure that has been postponed. And my attitude would be that we're going to discover through the next, you know, 2 or 3 month process kind of where we're at. And we keep the dialogue open. We see whether or not she calms down. We signal that she's important and that the relationship's important. But we are trying to we're just trying to move through this and see whether or not we can find some common ground to see eye to eye. If we can't, if what we get is female hysteria and a division of the a divisiveness in their little local village, then you have really gotten the answer that you need and consider yourself very lucky to have tripped over this essentially a diagnostic moment.
Yeah, because to me, the minute I read that somebody's telling their friends that someone's emotionally abusing them in this situation, I'm not turning any more rocks over. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, I would be done with this girl. But there's a reason why I'm not being definitive, and that is that this cannot be the first sign of trouble. Okay. In other words, so this relationship has weathered her personality up to this point, and this guy has seriously considered her and has proposed and was intending to marry her. So there must be some significant strengths from his perspective that is keeping him has him seriously interested. It's interesting that he did not roll over or any way back away from his position as he's describing this. And doesn't sound like he lost his cool. And so I'm just thinking that he knows he's in a bad spot, but she may be very beautiful. He may be very attracted to her. There may be very significant reasons, other reasons than just that, about what he may feel like it's time for him to get married, et cetera. But I will tell you, if there's ever a decision you don't want to rush, this is the one.
Mm-hmm. And if you were talking to the female in this situation, she was telling you this from the other side, what, if any, advice would you give to her?
I would, quite frankly, if I got this, I would sort of, my job, Nate, would be to would be to, as a clinical psychologist, I would be very gently asking her questions about what essentially what was the center of her anxiety. And the center of her anxiety is potentially that she may feel unloved. And so this may feel like actually a rejecting dynamic. And she may feel essentially insulted by this. This is sort of what it sounds like. Now, what I would do is I would continue to question her a little more deeply about what about this is so insulting, and sort of where did she come up with these ideas, and give me a feel for how she thinks things should be fair, et cetera. And then what we do is we actually come up with scenarios that actually demonstrate principles by using extremes. So this is a very useful way to teach people to learn things, and it's also an effective strategy in the process of conducting science. That what you want to do is you want to do things at the extremes. That's why they use atom smashers, and that's why they use huge telescopes, is that they're trying to go to the extremes to learn things. And in this case, what we would do is we would say, okay, let's suppose that a man had a fortune of $1 billion, okay, and he's marrying someone who has nothing. What should be the process by which they go about this? Would it be wise for him to essentially say, we are partners as we go forward, my interests make $100 million a year, so you will be joining in that, but if we split up, my $1 billion is my $1 billion, okay? And at that point, we try to use this, we try to use extreme examples to try to educate somebody about sort of the realities of fairness. And we question them about this, and I would try to tease out of her gently why it is that she feels like she's entitled to this man's net worth, okay? And then I would disagree with her about this, and I would explain to her that actually we're not entitled to anything in this world, and we're certainly not entitled to anybody else's money. And that if we're in a romantic relationship, there are reasonable expectations that we will live in the same house under similar financial circumstances, but entitlement to someone else's savings and fortune is something that is absolutely something that we should not expect coming into a relationship. And that is I would be calibrating this woman about the realities of how it is that she should look at the situation. And if it turns out that she cannot manage to be educated, then that's fine. Then I will have done my job, just as this man can attempt to do the job that I'm describing, by making sure that he communicates that in no way was this meant to be insulting, that this was just meant to be sort of responsible, and that he would be more than fair if it turned out that things did not go well, and that, of course, we indeed hope that everything would go well. But we're going to be responsible about this, and that's how it is that we would need to proceed. Now, I have no idea, obviously, whether or not she has the capability of absorbing and recalibrating her expectations. Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't.
Okay. On this same vein, now we have it from a female's perspective. Here's another live example.
Okay,
so this is a female. She's 25 years old, and her boyfriend, Pete, is 30 years old. So I've been seeing my boyfriend, Pete, for 6 months, and it's been really wonderful. I really thought I'd found the one with him, but after last night, I feel like my world's collapsed, and I'm not sure I've made the right decisions or if I was right. I've never felt like this about anyone before, but now it feels like my heart's been pulled out of my chest and I can't sleep. So my good friend, who we'll call Dave, was my boyfriend from the age of 18 to 21, after which we broke up because we wanted different things in life. We stayed good friends, though, because we had a great friendship and had been through so much together. He currently lives in a different country at the moment, but we still talk semi-regularly online and on different on different apps. Now, mm-hmm. Pete knew that Dave was a friend of mine, but he didn't know he was an ex until about 2 weeks ago, when Dave asked me to visit him in Amsterdam while he's on a work trip. I live in the UK, he lives in Italy. Now, I had already agreed and booked a ticket before I told Pete, because they were on sale for a ridiculously low price on the dates that he would be there, so I jumped at the opportunity. My boyfriend Pete seemed cool with it at first, but after a few days asked me if there was any history between us. I was honest and told him there was. He didn't seem too bothered, and eventually asked if I thought visiting an ex in another country was appropriate while in a relationship. I asked him how Dave and my relationship wasn't like that and that we were strictly platonic. He didn't seem to really react. He just gave me a look that was sarcastic, I suppose would be the best way to describe it. I then told him that I wouldn't be controlled and I hated men that thought they owned me and could tell me what to do. I told him I was free to see who I wanted and that I found his lack of trust in me upsetting, disrespectful, and perhaps a sign of future abusiveness. I now realize this may have been a bad thing to say. Again, he didn't really react, so I thought that was the end of it. Then, last night, he came around to my apartment and broke up with me. I asked him why, and tried to get him to explain himself. And he told me that he was going away, that my going away to see another man was a deal breaker, that he'd been in this type of situation before and wasn't going to go through it again. I asked him if this was an ultimatum because I hate ultimatums and think that they are tools of abusers. And he said, no, it's not an ultimatum. I've decided to break up with you. I have not presented you with any options. I just came to say goodbye. Before I could say or do anything more, he kissed me on the forehead, said goodbye, and walked away. He didn't seem angry, just sad. So I tried to call him afterwards, but he just texted me some baloney about how this was for the best and that he wished me no ill will and hopes I'll be happy. He turned his phone off while I bombarded him with texts and voicemails. To make matters worse, I told Dave, the guy in Amsterdam, about what happened, and he replied, oh, well, I guess that means we can have even more fun then. He didn't care about my relationship and my pain. He just wanted a hookup buddy and someone to get stoned with while he was in Amsterdam. Now I've lost someone I love and my best friend, who I was only interested in as friends. Has a different motive to me for meeting up. I feel like I've lost my partner and I've lost a best friend at the same time. I tried calling Pete today, my ex-boyfriend now, about an hour ago, and he just actually answered. He told me that I should look to be with someone who wasn't so abusive. And he said, please stop calling me. This is over. Have a nice trip. And then he blocked my number. How could he do that to someone he loves? Is he overreacting or was I? What should I do now?
Well, the nice little story here. And I would say that this is a possible learning opportunity for this young lady. So I say possible learning opportunity because I don't know if what we've got here is a personality limitation on her part, or whether or not, you know, this is sort of young and miscalibrated about the nature of life, and therefore she messed this up pretty badly, and whether or not she might be capable of doing a better job in the future. The truth is that her position was completely and totally out of line. You do not 6 months into a romantic relationship go and visit an ex-boyfriend in another country, for God's sakes. This is all just ludicrous. So this is particularly if there's any, it would be one thing if your relationship is so outstanding and so secure, which would be very unlikely in 6 months. But if it was so outstanding and so secure that your partner literally could trust you and did, okay, that would be a very unusual set of circumstances where you would want to go see some ex-boyfriend in another country and you would get this ticket or whatever and wouldn't have discussed it with your boyfriend, and then it turns out that he's still completely cool with it. You know, ludicrous. This is a ludicrous situation. So there's nothing abusive about this. There's nothing controlling about Pete's behavior in this regard at all. This, in fact, his response seems very measured. If a young man or a man is not somewhat anxious and guarding of your sexuality, then he's not very interested in you. So this would be a very, very minimal jealousy response on the part of this young man. And his response, as the story is being told here, is quite extraordinary. And frankly, it appears that he has read some character deficiency cues in this young lady and has basically said, this is a bad deal for me, I'm out of here, which is a very good decision on his part. So the young lady now needs to back up and understand a little bit more about human nature. And the human nature, we do not cavalierly make decisions of this magnitude when we are fortunate enough to be in a romantic relationship that is alive and well in 6 months. Most romantic relationships that start out with promise are dead by 6 months. So we are fortunate enough to be one that is actually alive and quite well, then we should treat it very, very carefully. It should be treated like a very, very excellent job that you want to keep, or a very or a favorite possession, prized possession. You should be very, very careful with it and not sloppy. As it turns out, as we find out in the story, that the Pete's suspicions as to the actual dynamics of the situation turn out to be accurate. It turns out the ex-boyfriend was certainly interested in nailing this girl while he was on vacation in Amsterdam. And so that also becomes apparent. So whether or not she was utterly and totally naive about this is really quite irrelevant. She was young and irresponsible and miscalibrated as to the appropriate way to defend a relationship. And quite frankly, she got what she deserved. And that's okay. That's how you – sometimes you have to learn the hard way, and she learned one the hard way, and maybe she takes a hard look at this and doesn't make that kind of mistake in the future.
And so, you know, over the last story, you were saying that if the person is not responsible enough or conscientious enough, that they're just not going to fare well in romantic relationships. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, you know, Nate, romantic relationships are not for irresponsible people, and they're not for gutless people. You got to be courageous, and you have to. The woman in the first story had no courage. In other words, somehow she was expecting to piggyback on somebody else's fortune, and was all upset about having to assume any personal financial responsibility for the rest of her life. And so that was an outrageous position to be in, and that sort of outrageous position is going to basically make it impossible for a romantic relationship to actually grow and solidify. In the end of the day, people do not wind up being consistently interested in each other for very long if they don't admire each other as people. And the problem is that a lot of people are not very admirable as individuals. And so as a result, they are doomed to have intermittent, intermediate-term sort of relationships that then don't work out very well. And now, if you are a responsible, capable human being and you have a romantic relationship, you are very fortunate, but that guarantees nothing. That doesn't mean that the spark is going to remain alive and that you're going to be interested in each other physically. It may be that you will love each other tremendously as you grow and appreciate the other person's character as you watch it through time. So a lot of people wind up with that problem. That's an extremely common problem. But the first problem of irresponsibility that we see in both of these scenarios, from my standpoint, these individuals are essentially doomed unless they do an awful lot of learning and they discover some courage and the nature of personal responsibility that is required to have relationships that are this potentially conflicted and this potentially tricky to manage. So romantic relationships are special, and they're not for children, and they're not for flakes, and they are not for selfish people. They are for really remarkable people. And so these two people that have, the two women in this case, in these last two scenarios, have not been sufficiently remarkable. We might hope that they may grow into that if they're lucky.
And so what advice do you have for people if they feel like they're, like, if, you know, how does somebody become not gutless? My assumption is the more disagreeable someone is, the less gutless they are, but it seems like that's not actually the case.
Yeah, there's when I talk about gutless, there is courage, there's conscientiousness is a component of this, and as well as some degree of disagreeability. If you are if you're overly agreeable and very conscientious, life can be very hard for you. You may be a marvelous human being, but it's going to be, you're going to have to be lucky in a romantic relationship to not be hooked up with somebody that's going to exploit you, and then there's going to be trouble. But in any event, probably the most fundamental issue here is going to be conscientiousness. And that's for people that haven't heard me talk about this before. This is kind of what we would call character. Okay, it's a tendency to do things the right way, to do things appropriately, and to be reasonable with other people about the rules and expectations of our behavior and theirs. And so the people that are lower in conscientiousness are going to tend to have trouble in this area for the following reason, that if you can imagine two business people that make a deal with each other on a handshake at 23 years old, and if we then follow these people the next 50 years and we find out that they're still doing business together 50 years later, what we're seeing is we're seeing a couple of people that were stable and responsible and could be trusted, okay? And there might have been times when one of the two of them had to make an adjustment, and it was might have been some hard things that they had to explain, as they might have had to renegotiate things. But if they're still doing business together 50 years later, that tells us a tremendous amount about their sense of fair play and their honor. The same thing is true with two people who really care about who it is the other as a person, and that they too meet at 25 years old and they're still together 50 years later, and they still love that other individual and they're still trading with them in life. Romances are trades, okay? They are the most complex trade that human beings do. We trade more time and energy, more of our life with our romantic partner than with anybody else. And so if people are inherently good traders, then they are potentially inherently good romantic partners. And if they are inherently lousy traders, show me somebody that's a lousy employee, that was an irresponsible student and a lousy employee and manages their money poorly and is upset and angry and always wanting more out of some deal and feels like they're being treated unfairly by the world. You show me that individual and my Ouija board tells me that a long-term happy romantic relationship is fundamentally impossible to that individual. And so this is we are talking at people in this podcast that have the capability of doing what needs to be done in order to qualify and remain in romantic relationships. And there are problems and there are challenges. But these two situations that we've talked about tonight simply expose the limitations of the individuals that were involved.
And people can fake conscientiousness and all that character for quite a long time, from what I gather reading a lot of these stories here.
They can fake it for they can fake it for a while, and a person that's highly motivated that is determined enough might fake it long enough to get a ring on her finger or to get a girl to say yes. And so I've seen that happen before, I've actually seen a salesperson very effectively cover up his alcoholism for more than 2 years in a courtship. And then as soon as he got his prize bride, then we saw the truth, and it was a fiasco. So people are capable of this. This is why I'm never upset when we're heading towards the wedding, or we've been in a situation long term and we've agreed to get married, and then all hell breaks loose. Then something happens and there's a big fiasco, like these two incidences we talked about. Those are beautiful. Those actually finally stressed people enough that we got to see their character more clearly. And those are very illuminating and important incidences. Great people in great romances don't let little crap like this ever get in their way.
Well, speaking of which, we've got another example here. So
got
this
it.
Is from a 21-year-old female, and her acquaintance is 23-year-old male. So Jason and I knew each other back in high school, but we were never close. We text occasionally, but that's about it. About a month back, he asked me to meet up, and I agreed because I hadn't seen him in a while, and I had just broken up with my boyfriend, so I figured it might be good to get out there. So at this point, to my knowledge, he's single. So we meet up, start talking. One thing led to another, and we slept together. Afterwards, he suggested being friends with benefits, but I wasn't interested, so I told him that. Today, I met up with another acquaintance who knows Jason, and he mentioned that Jason has a girlfriend that he's been with for 2 years. I felt like absolute crap when I heard that. I just helped him cheat. Well, I find out what her Facebook name is, and I'm thinking about messaging her, but I don't know if that's wise. What should I do?
Yeah, I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't get anywhere near any mess like that. What you feel fortunate that you have found out that this was that you were a casual mating strategy target for this young man, and once again, the young lady asked for it. The intelligent way to defend yourself against casual mating strategy, which is for those of listeners that have not listened to previous podcasts, human beings have two primary mating strategies. One we're going to call pair bond strategy, or what we call true love strategy, and the other is going to be what we call casual mating strategy, or short-term mating strategy. And as the way this works, males are designed by nature early in relationships to push for short-term mating in order to essentially accomplish the following goal. If they are able to have sex early, very early, with a minimum of investment, then that's a likely signal that the female actually thinks that the male is so fancy that it is worth going to bed with him without any evidence of long-term commitment. So this is a signal to the male that the female considers him genetically superior, and therefore the male then very, very likely will lose interest quite quickly, because even if he might have been more interested in the female, he's now less interested in the female as a long-term partner. So the female's job here is to, if she's truly interested in a guy, the right move is to not be so quick to be sleeping with him. You know, 21-year-olds can be excused for this kind of mistake, of course. Anyone could. But what I'm saying is, this is a typical young adult Stone Age brain decision. And if you want to make better decisions, then what you do is you don't sleep with anybody until he's paid for you on multiple occasions on dates. Paid. So he actually had to provision you. We didn't just go out and hang out. Okay. I tell women in my practice, I tell them that the guys should pay 10 times. There should be 10 paid dates before he gets to your sexual treasury. Your sexual treasury as a female in the Stone Age is very, very expensive. Every sex act in nature between humans would result in a 5% chance of pregnancy. Even though we defend that today with birth control, we can't defend the psychological consequences of it. So sexual activity is biologically expensive for females, and it is psychologically expensive for females. And so therefore, you'll get females actually talking as if, as they say, every man they sleep with takes a little piece of their soul. And, of course, that's ridiculous, but the point is that there's a there can be a feeling that you have been had, that you've been used. And if you don't want to have that feeling, then defend your sexuality with 10 paid dates or another reasonable strategy like that. Now, in terms of retaliating and tattletaling and signaling the girlfriend that she's been cheating on, this is this is, of course, ridiculous. There's no reason to do anything of the kind. That relationship is going to spin out however it's going to spin out, and we don't need to be part of a justice situation in order to intervene in that fiasco. Just move on, learn the lesson, and make better decisions in the future.
And, of course, in future dates, don't tell the guy that you're going to wait 10 dates, because then you've just set a goal for him.
Of course not. Of course not. You're completely cryptic.
I remember a friend of mine had heard you talk about this exact topic, and so she decided that she was going to be upfront and honest with a man she was dating, that she's going to be waiting 10 dates. And, of course, by date 12, he was out of there. And it was
I can't believe anybody missed the point of this. But, you know, sometimes
just in case.
Can't be too explicit in your instructions. You got it.
All jokes aside, though, I kind of brought this up to a couple of female friends and female relatives, this kind of concept of holding out until the guy pays. And one comment that was consistently made was, well, and this was actually males and females made this, is, well, isn't that like treating like a girl like a prostitute if you're basically wait till the guy pays for you and then you sleep with him?
That's a ludicrous thing. Here's the point. The point is that we are looking for esteem signals from the male. Does the male value the female enough that he is actually seeing in as he gets to know her, that his interest in her is indefinite? And so, therefore, of course he's attracted to her, and of course he would like to have sex with her, but he is patient, and he is signaling that patience as well as his intention to provision her indefinitely, as in the next 25 years. Okay? So we are looking for we're really looking for his Stone Age signal inside of his head, where he has shunted her in terms of his decision making completely out of casual mating strategy target into pair bond strategy. Now, there's nothing prostitutional about this at all. What's going on here is the female is not obligated to sleep with this guy at all. She's vetting him. She is actually taking herself off the market for this period of time, in all probability, and she is seeing him probably exclusively over a period of several weeks, where she's trying to decide whether or not this is worth risking a Stone Age pregnancy, for God's sakes, which is a pretty big deal psychologically for a lot of females. Now, it's not for all females. Some females are sort of unusually easy as far as that goes. But most females are actually relatively conservative. And so they would just as soon smoke out trouble and not have had sex with a male. And that would be a better decision-making strategy for them than to jump in quick, then find out 2 or 3 weeks later it's not working out, and then he has another notch on his buckle, and she has the Stone Age psychology of actually have this lingering Stone Age anxiety that she could be pregnant with somebody that she's not going to have a long-term relationship with. So these are what it is that we're doing, and I'm confused that anyone could see this as in any way prostitutional. The guy is not buying his way into the eggs. He is allowing himself to be vetted. Okay, if at a later point she's convinced that this is a very appropriate place for her to be sexual, then have at it. It's all good. But don't rush it and set up a mental place where we are essentially pushing his patience if, in fact, he's playing casual mating. You will find out pretty quickly if the guy's playing casual mating. And he will turn and run probably by date five and be all pissed and bent about it, which is just fine. Then he told you everything that you needed to know.
Okay. And I've never had the following experience, but I have talked to acquaintances just in passing with these type of examples and getting into conversations that there is some experience out there with these acquaintances where they'll date a woman with the intention of pair bonding, but at the same time, she's actually casually mating with a guy who I guess she perceives as extremely attractive on the side. Or on the other vein, where they're actually the guy who's on the side, they're the he-man, and she's not sleeping with a guy that she considers a pair bond material. I kind of look at it like this is just so far unusual for a very low conscientious woman, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's low conscientious female behavior. That is not typical female behavior, and females that would play those kinds of strategies are not females that are very likely to have long-term romantic love relationships. So those may be scheming females that wind up married to some poor schmuck with a good job, and they're a lazy flake with a pretty face or a good figure for a while until they get fat. So that game has been played a billion times on this planet in the last 10 years. So that is no issue, and that's really not what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in such individuals. I'm interested in the very noble and exquisite pursuit of romantic love, and that means two people finding each other that they really dig each other's humanity, that they really find each other's person to be fascinating, and they're sexually attracted to each other. And they feel like they have enough commonality about how they view the world and how they view their futures that they want to make a life together. That's what I'm interested in, and anything else is, is certainly part of human nature and part of the drama of human nature. But to me, that's not what it is that I'm interested in figuring out how to help people seek.
All right. And on that same vein, it looks like our final situation, our final life example, is a couple that seems to have found this type of situation for themselves. Is they are beautifully in love and have a wonderful situation here where the man is 34, his girlfriend is 37, but she has a daughter who's 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I have really no idea what to do. My girlfriend and I have been together for 8 years. I love her and her daughter, who I consider my own, and I honestly can't imagine my life without them. That said, things have gotten really tough with the daughter recently, her name is Millie. For as long as we've been together, it's always been hard to be seen in public with Millie alone. She is blonde, with blue eyes, and clearly not biologically mine. I'm a very dark-skinned Indian man, and I wear a turban because I'm Sikh. Whenever we're in public alone together, we get stopped and questioned a lot. For the last few years, I've been stopped and questioned by the police at least once a month with Millie. It's the same time, every time. They separate us, ask me some bullshit questions, and now that she's old enough to speak her mind, they grill Millie about me and how she knows me. When Millie was too young to understand things and express herself clearly, there was an incident where I was arrested after taking her into a family bathroom to change her diaper, and Millie was placed into state care for several hours until the cops could reach her mom to sort things out. The justification they used was that Millie was really upset and crying when we came out of the bathroom, and even after her mom sorted things out, she was visited by a social worker for a few months. Nothing that bad has happened since Millie started talking, but the questioning by the police hasn't stopped. It's gotten to the point where Millie now actively avoids going out in public with me alone and has asked her mom if she can hire a white nanny to pick her up from camp and drop her off this summer so I won't have to. I honestly don't know what to do. I know that Millie loves me and that she still wants to spend time with me, but I just don't know how I should respond to her request. To me, Millie is my daughter. I've been around since she was a baby, and I've been active in raising her. I know that she's still too young to understand things, but I can't help but feel terrible at her request. Since she asked last night, I haven't been able to sleep. I don't want her to grow up hating the fact that I look different than her, and I don't want her to be afraid of going out with me. I don't really know what advice I need, but anything is helpful. I just don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting type of a situation. My first, I have this little unit needs to solve this problem, and they're going to need to and solving this problem. What we actually have here is we have some interesting conflicts. And so we have a conflict of a man that's wearing a turban in the United States, and he is with what is likely to be a Caucasian love and her Caucasian blonde-haired, blue-eyed daughter. And so as a result of this, we can all ooh and awe about how human nature shouldn't be prejudiced or upset about this, but reality is reality. And so and particularly. Given the antipathy that exists between the Middle East and the Middle East Islamic religion and the United States and conventional American life here, and so as a result, you can expect now in terms of being stopped once a month by police, that seems like hyperbole, and I'd like to see the records on that. It's probably it might have happened 3 times in 4 months, and I doubt that it has happened 28 times in 28 months. That would be outrageous. However, even if it was outrageous, one would think that one would start to think about how one looks in public and whether or not that turban is worth it. Okay? So we start to get questions about what we are bringing to the situation and what we have control over. And as far as I'm concerned, someone's religion is between them and their own belief structure. It doesn't have to be something that's advertised to anybody. And so if you want to advertise that and you want to deal with the social consequences of that, then that's a choice that that individual is going to have to make. Now, there are also things that the family unit could do. So if the family unit wanted to, the way both the girlfriend and the girl dressed could be much more, could actually look much more like our writer here. So there would be ways that they could dress themselves that when he and she were in public that would make her look, for example, a little bit more Middle Eastern and a little bit more dramatic, essentially putting her in costume. And if there's such a love in this little family, they ought to be, the little girl may very well be willing to do this. And this would completely eliminate any baloney from cross-examination about anybody anywhere in sight. So I think that, that would be a very strong signal to the social world that this child and this man are very tight, they're bonded, and that they are, you know, essentially on the same team. So two ways that you can go. You can costume her, or you can walk away from some of your own expressions of your own religion in public, and you can look much more conventional. And by looking much more conventional, I guarantee you, if you're walking around the United States in very conventional clothes with a little blonde girl, nobody's going to say a word to you. So we have to understand that you are bringing some of this on yourself, and those are choices and some interesting choices that individual is going to have to deal with.
Now, I read this and I thought, I guess I started thinking that the problem here is him having to prove that she's actually his daughter or, you know, his stepdaughter. And I thought, why don't they just take a family picture that he keeps in his wallet? And then if anybody
Sure.
stops him, he can just
Good.
show them and say, you know, there's her mother, there's me, and that's her.
Actually,
But.
that's excellent. That's excellent. And I think, I think anything like that is good. But I also think these other sort of costume markings are very powerful for people. And I think that would keep everybody shut up and everybody away if they were to do that. And certainly, this is absolutely a personal choice on the part of this man that he is essentially asking for this kind of scrutiny. And he can walk away from this scrutiny at any time. And in my judgment, any signals that one has to show their religion is not something that you are signaling God or Allah or anybody else. You are signaling that to other people, okay? And so you have to decide whether or not you want to signal that to other people and you want the consequences of that signal. And so it's important that we keep the values very straight here and that we look clearly at the cost-benefit of these choices and that we realize that it is unreasonable for us to ask the world to ignore our signals when those signals are part of a broader sociological, truly, that those signals are part of the biggest sociological problem that our world currently faces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what you're saying is that people really can't expect other people to change just because we wish that they would.
No, you know, this is a very important principle, and one of the finest books I ever read in self-help was a book called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by the investment advisor, economist Harry Brown, really quite a philosopher. And Harry Brown was actually the candidate for President of the United States for the Libertarian Party, I think twice, which largely on the stature of this book. And the book isn't particularly political. It's a statement about how to look at the world. And he makes very clear the following issue, and that is that there are things that we're going to call direct alternatives, that you can do things and nobody else can stop you and you can change your life. And then there are what we're going to call indirect alternatives, where you have to change everybody else in the world so that they'll do things so that things are done the way that you would like them, okay? Now, this scenario is setting up a classic frustration around the indirect alternative. Like, gee, I wish everybody would let me send my signal about my religion and not give me any hassle about it at the same time, okay? Well, they won't, okay? And experience has shown that this is going to be a problem. So you now have a direct alternative that you can just fix it. And so we may not like direct alternatives, but it is incredibly important to understand when you are in power and you can change your circumstances and when you are not in power and you can't. This is a beautiful example of if this man wants this love relationship to thrive and he wants to be with this little family and he feels like he has the psychological gold that human beings so desperately seek, then he should respect the fact that sometimes that involves some sacrifices. And he has in front of him a beautiful direct alternative that he could use, and he could have a very fine life with a very small price, as far as I'm concerned.
I now have another book to read. Thank you, Dr. Lau.
Good. I'm surprised I didn't tell you about that. That one is one of the great ones.
I love the title. Love the title.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to wrap it for this week. Thank you again. This is a phenomenal insight, as always. Again, you know, I always say this shouldn't be called evolutionary psychology. It should be called revolutionary psychology.
Yes. Yeah, this is a whole new way of looking at things, and with it, gives us a lot of power over our happiness and our well-being.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.